think that's why he asked him, why were you so afraid? How's it possible you don't trust me? Haven't you seen me work miracles before? And they had, with their own eyeballs. And all that aside, Jesus said, we are going to the other side. And sure enough, they got there. And that's not a small thing. Once a year, sometimes it's good to do an inventory, especially if you've had a big change in your life this last year. You didn't know how you're going to survive. It's a good idea to just go back and make an account of how God took care of you. And save it, because you'll get lied to later. The next time you're facing unfamiliar territory, it's a good idea to remember, you know what? Jesus got us through that storm. He'll get us through the next one. And the next thing you know, the lies just bounce off like bullets off of Superman's chest. They don't penetrate. That's our first rabbit trail, by the way. We're only 5 words into the chapter. Let's get going. Immediately when Jesus got out of the boat, verse 2, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. All of the Gospels say a man except Matthew. Matthew says two men. And I think the facts of the stories are, they're just too similar for it to be two separate incidents. And so the way that most of the Bible scholars I know have resolved it is that, you know, the other Gospels only deal with the one man who was prominent, who was the spokesman. And Matthew, for some reason, mentions both of them. Man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet them. This is one of the reasons why I think the storm was demonically inspired. Because it seems that some of the language in this confrontation that Jesus has with the demons in this man, that maybe they expected him. And I think the storm was intended to thwart his efforts. Satan has to yield to God's power. He has to. But he never does without a fight. And that's one of the things that we can see. And you see it as you, the closer that you look at this confrontation, even Jesus, even though they knew who he was, even though they knew their destiny, ultimately, they still resisted and didn't give up till they absolutely have to yield. And that's an important thing to remember, because the devil always does his blowfish thing. C.S. Lewis said about Satan's power, the two mistakes Satan would like you to make about him. Number one is that you would exaggerate his power and influence over you so that you'd be afraid. And the other is that you'd ignore him altogether and think it's no big deal. And you would love if you made either one of those mistakes. The Bible calls him an evil genius. So all of the caricature pictures that we have of a scrawny little guy in red tights with a pitchfork tail and horns, and not him. He is a powerful being, and all of his servants have great power. But in 1 John, John, who witnessed these events, wrote in his epistle to the entire church, he said, the one that lives in you is greater than the one that's ruling in this world system. So you don't have to be afraid of him. So he comes to meet him. Let's look at this guy's condition. He lives in the tombs. I think the wording is interesting in my NIV. No one could bind him anymore, not even with chain, which implies that they'd tried. They'd tried everything. Because he had often been chained, hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. It's really graphic in Greek. The verb tenses and everything speak of when he smashes the fetters, the iron shackles. He smashes them to pieces. When he breaks the chains, whatever it is, they put bigger chains on, he breaks those to pieces. And the language could be that he just took literally every piece of the chain and broke it. Here's what they think about you, stinking chains, breaks them into pieces, throws them in a pile. You got a bigger chain? And he broke that too. What does that tell me? That tells me this is not some guy that's high on PCP or, you know, just an adrenaline junkie or something. This is a guy who has superhuman power inhabiting him. That kind of a guy would be intimidating unless you're God. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Lest you just think that all of this is like fairy tales and superstition. There is a lot of superstition surrounding Satan, even in the church. But that doesn't deny the fact that he is real. There are lots of documented cases from secular sources even, not just Christian sources, of people who have been possessed by the power of Satan. People with bite marks on their body in places that they can't reach with their teeth. People who are locked away in solitary confinement. A couple of years ago, a guy broke into the Calvary Chapel up in Bangor and did horrible damage. And by the time the police got there, he's spouting all kinds of foul things against Jesus and scared the policemen. And they unloaded on him, I forget how many rounds of heavy weapons fire on him before he even went down where they could grab him. And it took about five guys to grab him, take him to the hospital. Interesting that the very next day, Pastor Ken was there telling him about Jesus, which I just, I love that. So this is a guy who's, this is the classic example of Satan's agenda in somebody's life. He doesn't come up front and say, "Hi, I'm Satan. I'm your relentless enemy. I just want to let you know that I totally intend to isolate you, rip off your life, enslave you, and torment you. So I'll let you know." No, he comes in completely subtle ways, and he usually comes questioning whether God has good ideas or not. And he comes offering a shortcut, or he comes offering a way to have what it is that you want versus what God wants for you. And a lot of us have bitten on that bait. But here's the agenda, I think, in a nutshell. Satan comes to enslave, to isolate, to torment, and to destroy. And you see all of those things in this man. He lives alone. I find especially poignant in verse 5. It says that night and day among the tombs and in the hills he would cry out and cut himself with stones. If he couldn't scare other people, the enemy's just tormenting this man, crying constantly. Did Jesus know? Jesus had never personally been to this part of Israel. Yeah, this was his first foray over here in all of his ministry. And once again, I believe that's the reason that he came, was to rescue this man. It's interesting to me, as we see Satan's agenda, then we get to see Jesus' agenda, what it is that he wants to do for this man. It's also interesting that despite the huffing and puffing and the blowfish thing, despite the perhaps exaggerated testimony of how many demons there were, it didn't even matter. Jesus changed everything with the word. He didn't have to sweat. I was raised on Marvel comic books. And you know that in Marvel comic books, Spider-Man's going to have to fight against Doc Ock. Octor, Superman's going to fight against Lex Luthor or Bizarro Superman or something, that somehow the extreme bad guy and the extreme good guy are going to duke it out, and you're just hoping that the good guy wins. And that's not what this confrontation is. Even the confrontation with the life-threatening storm, a global manifestation of or localized global manifestation of Satan's power wasn't any contest for Jesus. He's the creator, so it wasn't a big deal. He just, with a word, calmed everything. Interesting, though, to see that Satan's bravado. Verse 6, when he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. The phrase, fell on his knees, I know at least one translation says he worshipped him, which I think is an accurate translation, but the Greek word is the word proskuneo, which is one of its usages. Its primary usage is to worship. Its root includes giving a kiss, so it's a word of worship. Its secondary or tertiary usage, though, not used as often, but I believe used here, and when the wise men came to see the baby Jesus, it simply means to bow down and to pay homage to someone as a superior. And though it's not the primary usage, I think that's the one that's used here. So he comes in his entire posture, though he's terrifying everybody else. His entire posture with Jesus is to fall down before him. He fell on his knees in front of him, and he shouted at the top of his voice. And like I said, that's usually what people do when they're really afraid and intimidated. They just talk louder. I've seen bullies do this. If somebody ever stands up to him, it kind of is so unnerving that they usually get meaner and louder and nastier. They're not used to it. They're used to people cowing in front of them. And so that's what's behind this shouting, probably. What do you want with me? Mind your own business, euphemistically. I do find it interesting that the demon said, Jesus, Son of the Most High God. This is not the only time the demons knew who Jesus was by sight. And maybe you don't think about this, but in my brain, this really makes me wonder, how did they know what he looks like? How would they know from a distance who this was? Satanic post offices, maybe, you know? Mugshots, you know, face on, profile, public enemy number one, you know, Jesus of Nazareth, avoid at all costs, you know, and Jesus standing there with, you know, that blank look on his face and long hair and the beard and everything. I don't know, but they knew who he was. They knew exactly who he was. Their theology was perfect. Which I do find interesting because some of his own followers weren't convinced who he was. Here's the other thing that always stands out in my mind. I'm going to read to you 7 things that the demons know about Jesus that are shown in this passage. And the thing that I find is so interesting about them is that these are the very things that Satan and his friends are constantly lying to us about, and yet they know that they're true. And that might give us weapons to fight back with. 7 things in this passage that I see that the demons know about Jesus. Number 1, in verse 7, they know that he's the Son of God. And that's not a small thing. Like I said, there were conflicting opinions amongst the religious leaders of Israel about who he was. But the demons knew. Notice, he's not just a road to God. He's not just a good teacher, rebel without a cause. You know, all the varying opinions, even in churches, that people have about Jesus. The demons knew exactly who he was. 2nd thing on my list is they knew that he was more powerful than they are. And I had you underline the word begged. This is not the posture of somebody dealing from the upper hand. This is the posture of somebody that knows that they're in trouble. 3rd thing I wrote is they know that Jesus will keep his promises. Again, verse 7. And here's what I find so interesting. This is the number one lie of Satan, isn't it? Is that God isn't going to keep his promises? If we believed that God was going to keep his promises, we would be different people. But the demons believed that Jesus would keep his promise, because notice in verse 7 it says, swear that you won't torture us. If you just swear and say the word that you won't do it, we will believe you. Heck, we don't even believe that he'll keep his promises, but they do. Fourth thing I wrote down the demons believe about Jesus from this passage is that they believe that he's merciful. How many times have you been lied to about this by your enemy? That's it. You've gone one step too far. That's it. You are toast, buddy. You're going to finally get what you deserve. What does mercy mean? It means not getting what you deserve. The demons were asking Jesus to not give them what they deserve, hoping that what they have heard about him being merciful would apply to them. I don't believe this is a change in allegiance, but it just is interesting. It's just interesting. Matthew adds, right after verse 7, that you won't torment us before the appointed time. And Luke adds that you won't send us to the abyss, the bottomless pit, which is their ultimate destiny. And this could be a fabulous rabbit trail. I'm just not going to spend a lot of time on it. But this means that the demons know their destiny. Right now, Bill is teaching downstairs. He's teaching the book of Revelation, which is sort of the look at the final chapter in who wins and who doesn't win and what happens. And the amazing thing to me is that Satan fights right up to the very end. And here the demons knew what their destiny was. How delusional can you be? It's interesting that they knew. And that's my fifth thing the demons know about Jesus. They know that he will ultimately and permanently judge evil. One of the little wedges in the door that the arguments of Satan often get with believers is when something really bad happens, is to say, see, God isn't in control. The bad people are just going to keep getting away with it, and God won't do one stinking thing about it. He can't be trusted. Or, you know, variations of that argument. But the demons knew what was coming for them. They also knew there was an appointed time for it, that their time was limited. The Bible says in another place that Satan knows his time is limited. Interesting theology from a demon. Verse 6, they know that they are not verse 6, thing 6 on my list of the seven things the demons know about Jesus, and that they know that they are subject to his authority. And I had you underline the word allow over in verse 12. And also in verse 13, he gave them permission. Does that ring a bell? Those of you who came on Wednesday night when we studied Job, remember Job chapter 1 and 2? Satan comes and asks God for permission to inflict havoc in Job's life. And he had to ask for permission. And even when God gave him permission, there were parameters. Yes, you can touch him, but you have to stay in these boundaries. And God's intention was ultimately to prove something. And of course, God was going to bless Job far more than he suffered for a short period of time. But Satan can't do anything without permission. The demons know that. And they know him by his presence. I've talked to lots of people. I can think of a few people that are here today who the minute that you moved into the neighborhood that you moved into, or you went on the job that you now have, you realized that you walked into enemy territory. some people when they first started coming to this church. And I hate talking about the devil. This is the most I've probably ever talked about the devil. I don't like doing it. I'd rather shine the spotlight on Jesus. But it's interesting that the minute you move in a Godward direction in or take Jesus with you into a dark place, there will be resistance. I've seen people that started having nightmares that they'd never had before. And that is the blowfish thing also. But it's when you have Jesus living in you and you walk into enemy territory, he knows that Jesus is there. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. That means you don't go in unarmed. If you go in with Jesus in you, then a greater power has just walked into that arena than the power that's been controlling it. And that's important to know. That's why John said what he said in 1 John chapter 4. He said, yeah, the world system is serving God's purposes, and he's got a lot of servants out there, serving Satan's purposes, and he's got a lot of servants out there, but the one that lives in you, you belong to God, and the one that lives in you is greater than the one that lives in the world. 1 John chapter 4. I made a note as we read through verse 8 that Jesus had been saying, more than once he said, come out of this man, you evil spirit. And eventually, however many demons there were, let's talk about that. Verses 9 and 10, Jesus said, what's your name? And he says, my name is Legion, because we are many. A Roman legion was 6,000 soldiers. Does that mean there were 6,000 demons in this guy? Don't know. We do know that when Jesus said, okay, you can go into the pigs, and they went into the pigs, there were 2,000 pigs. Does that mean they were all deviled ham? They were all possessed? I don't know. It doesn't tell us that. But here's what I suspect, because I know how the devil always works. He always exaggerates his power and his influence to intimidate. How many battles he wins simply because he does the booga, booga, booga thing, you know, I'm bad, and we fall for it. I don't like to pick fights with him at all, but man, if Jesus wants to go and pick some fights with him, I don't want him to be held back simply because I'm chicken to be there. So it could be this was just an intimidation thing. I got to pick up my notes. Maybe there weren't 6,000 of them. Maybe there were. I don't think it would have mattered how many there were for Jesus to do what he did. He begged Jesus, verse 10, not to send them out of the area.